Welcome to the Wolf Connection podcast. I'm your host, John Kalfa. Let's talk about some wolves. Joining us today, also in Gardner, Montana, she is one of the project technicians with the Yellowstone Wolf Project, Maddie Jackson. Maddie, how are you doing up there in Gardner? I know you said you were a little disappointed. You were waiting for snow today and nothing seems to be coming down, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing pretty good. It started snowing a little bit this morning and I had my fingers crossed that we'd get quite a bit of snow for skiing this weekend, but it's since died down. But there's always tomorrow.
Yeah, you guys, what's the typical snowfall up in Gardner? And are you guys getting less this year or less predictability in terms of the weather? What's going on up there?
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed this year that we've had quite a bit less snow, at least than we did last year. Like, just north of Gardner is Paradise Valley. And when I drive through Paradise Valley, there's not very much snow up there at all. But as you get higher up in elevation, if you go up to the Lamar Valley, there's more snow up there. So it's better skiing if you go into the park.
Has that been affecting the animals at all?
I think it makes things a bit easier for the ungulate species. So the elephant bison, they have to dig through the snow in order to eat the grass under the snow, which is pretty poor nutritional condition at this point in the year. But it's a lot easier for them when the snow isn't as deep. I think it helps those guys, which makes life a little bit more difficult for the wolves because they're a bit harder to hunt when they're having an easier time.
So I want to talk to you too because you grew up in Minnesota, so you're in really like the two big places where wolves are running wild and then there's parks there. So what was that like growing up there? Because you said you went to the International Wolf Center, which one of your friends and colleagues, Taylor Blandon, was telling us about just this week. And there's a Wildlife Science Center. So you were sort of, were you enthralled with wolves from an early age? And how did that spawn that interest in you?
Yeah. So I'm from Minnesota. I love being from Minnesota. Anybody who knows me well could tell you that I'm annoyingly in love with the state of Minnesota. The house that I grew up in was in a really great spot. I was very lucky. I grew up on a lake, a small lake. And so we had a lake on one side and a forest on the other side. So I could go explore in the forest and go, I used to go snorkeling in the lake with my dad when I was little to look at the fish. So I grew up with a really great fondness for like the outdoors and outdoor adventure and exploring ecosystems from a young age, including going to northern Minnesota up to the Boundary Waters. Specifically, we would do family trips up there. And that's how I was introduced to the International Wolf Center. Because the International Wolf Center is in Ely, Minnesota, which is considered the gateway to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. When I was really little, when I was like 10-ish, we would go and visit, and I went a few times. I remember just being totally enthralled by all of the stories that they had at the International Wolf Center, like all of the stories about the biologists specifically. I was like, just totally awestruck by how many cool people were out there studying wolves. And there was a piece of me that was like, I want to do that someday. That sounds pretty awesome. The International Wolf Center was great. And then also there's a photographer based out of Ely, Minnesota named Jim Brandenburg. And when I was little, we would go visit his gallery in Ely. And he has some really great pictures of wolves. And I remember seeing those when I was little. And that was kind of something that drew me in when I was little. And then also my Girl Scout troop, when I was younger, we would go to the Wildlife Science Center, which used to be at the Carlos Avery location in Forest Lake, but it's now in Stacy, Minnesota. They moved just before I left Minnesota. And they have one of the largest captive populations of wolves in the United States, and they do a lot of education. So we would go and visit them and get to see all of the wolves. And they also have cougars and bears and raptors, lots of things. So it was really fun to get to go see all of those animals and learn about them and the role that they have in the ecosystem. So that was a big part of it for me too. And so I later in college, I volunteered there to help with the animals. So I would go, I remember carrying buckets of water on cold January mornings to go fill the water buckets for all of the wolf enclosures.
yeah, we definitely know what that's about. Steven, did you have something you wanted to?
Yeah. What's the current status of gray wolves in Minnesota? Last I read, it looked like there were a lot more than there were in the late 70s, for example.
Yeah, so the population estimate, the current population estimate, I think is at about, 2,500 wolves in Minnesota. So yeah, Minnesota is the only state in the lower 48 where wolves weren't entirely extirpated. So we had a population of wolves throughout the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And I think a big part of that was because they lived in places that were really hard for people to get to, like the Boundary Waters and the Quetico in Canada, just north of Minnesota. It's pretty tough to get to because there's a lot of lakes, and so you can't really build roads through it. So the wolves had a little bit of a refuge there.
So when you were young, did you ever meet Jim Brandenburg, by the way? Because we interviewed Julia Huffman, who did her movie Medicine of the Wolf, and he was the star of that movie. So did you ever get to meet him and talk with him about his experiences when you went and visited his gallery?
Yeah, no, I have never had the privilege of meeting Jim Brandenburg, but I've seen his documentaries. He has one at the Bell Museum that's really cool to watch. That's one of my favorite exhibits at the Bell Museum in St. Paul, just outside of the St. Paul campus. But I haven't had the pleasure of meeting him in person.
And did you ever have any wolf experiences while you were growing up? Were there any, I know it's tough to see them out in the wild, especially in Minnesota, but were there any sightings that you had when you were out in the Boundary Waters or anything like that? Or was it just purely, you know, they were away and you just knew they were there? You just never got to see them with your own eyes?
When I was younger, I can't remember specifically having a direct encounter with a wolf besides like going and seeing tracks, which is really cool in and of itself. But there's a class that I took when I was a freshman in college called Predator Ecology of the North Woods. It's a January interim class. And I found out about it, actually. I got to go to the 2013 Wolf Conference in Duluth, Minnesota, and there was somebody there with a flyer for this class, and they were like, "Hey, you should check this out. You might be interested in it." And I was like, "Oh, heck yeah!" and that class is run by Brian Wood, who's a wonderful person. I've learned a lot from Brian about tracking and just Northwoods ecology in general. And as a part of this class, we would go take trips up to northern Minnesota and visit with biologists up there, including Shannon, who I ended up working for later after college. I remember being up there. There was one morning when we found a deer that wolves had killed out on the lake, right outside where we were staying for the class up in Ely, and we hiked out there to go check it out. And I remember thinking that was absolutely amazing. That's one of my fondest memories of that class and of the Northwoods. And then I remember hearing, also as a part of that class, hearing wolves howling on the other side of the lake, just off in the distance. And that's really something that it's hard to describe how that feels, to be in a wilderness setting or right on the edge of a wilderness setting, standing on the edge of a frozen lake at dusk and hearing wolves howling off in the distance in the Boundary Waters. It's pretty unreal.
And I got goosebumps just thinking about it with you guys standing out there and just listening to them howl. That's kind of cool. I know sometimes when I know when I rolled up this morning here at Wolf Connection, it was, I literally stepped out of my car and they were already in chorus. They were just singing, probably because they were waiting, you know, waiting to get fed. But what was that like? What sort of things were going through your body in that moment when you heard them howl and you were in that setting?
Yeah, you definitely feel like a little bit of a shiver down your spine. And you have to step back and take a beat and realize where you are and what's going on. I think that's definitely a good thing for people to do in life in general, but it's certainly a lot easier to do when you're in the wilderness listening to wolves howl. And actually, your story reminds me of working at the Wildlife Science Center. A lot of the times the wolves there would all start a howl, like one of them might start howling, and then the whole place would just start going. And that also is just really cool to hear, especially if you're standing right in the middle of it, because at the old facility, the enclosures were all around the perimeter. And so people would like walk around between all of the cages. And so you'd be right in the middle of it.
Almost like a sound enveloping you while you're standing there. Man, that's pretty awesome. That is very cool. So is that where, so when you were in the Wildlife Science Center and once you're, I guess, through with your studies at University of Minnesota, is that where you hooked up with Shannon Barbara Meyer with the Wolf Deer Project? Was that sort of an easy transition out of that? Or how did that come to be where you were working with her in terms of working with wolves?
Yeah, so I met Shannon a couple of times before I started working for her at the different Minnesota Wolf Stewards conferences, and also as part of that J-term class. Shannon was one of the biologists that the class would go and speak to up in Ely, and so she'd do a presentation, so I got to meet her then. So I met Shannon a few times at the conferences and through the class, and then on top of that, when I was at school at the University of Minnesota, the Wildlife Science Center hosts a class, usually during spring break, around spring, called Wildlife Handling and Chemical Immobilization, where they teach young biologists like myself how to handle the animals and anesthetize them safely. So because they have captive animals that they need to do that to give them vaccinations. And other things, that was an option for me, which was amazing. Like, that's not available to a lot of people. So I was very lucky to have that opportunity. So when I was applying for the position that Shannon was hiring for up in Ely, I had that capture or that handling experience, which was very valuable for me and has been since. And I wanted to give a shout out to Peggy Callahan, who's the director of the Wildlife Science Center. She was very instrumental in my early development for being a wolf biologist. So thanks, Peggy.
So what kind of influence did Peg have on you? Like, what were some of the things that she was able to, you know, I guess sort of rope you in, or what was it about her that made you really want to jump in 2 feet forward?
Yeah, I remember when I was first starting out at the Wildlife Science Center, Peggy was like way up here. Like, she kind of, like, I was scared to talk to Peggy because I held her in such high esteem. But after I got to know her a little, after a while, it was fine later on. Peggy is just a great educator. I'm incredibly passionate about the animals that she takes care of. And so that was definitely something that I learned early on, and just very, like, go-getter and, like, easy, very easy to chat with, like, just very down to earth. And definitely just a really, a wonderful female role model, which I have had a lot of, especially with Peggy and Shannon, some really, really amazing women that I've worked for, that have kind of paved the way for me.
Yeah. Speaking of these particular women, I was, you know, at the risk of putting you on the spot, which I obviously don't want to do, but you have a photo, your most recent photo on your Instagram that reads, "Women belong in all places where decisions are being made." That famous quote by Ruth Ginsburg. But do you feel that that's a conversation that needs to be had specifically in the community of outdoor wildlife professionals?
Yeah. And I think that it's a conversation that is being had. I see that it's changing. There are more women in positions of power. So that photo was taken the day after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. I got together with a group of people from Gardner to kind of commiserate and just chat about it. Yeah, but So historically, the conservation field has been male, lots of guys in charge. And at the higher levels, there are definitely more men in charge than women. But I see that shifting, especially there are a lot of women my age who are field technicians and now grad students. Some of my really good friends are grad students studying wildlife biology. And we've talked about this at length, and that there are a lot of young women in the field, but not a lot of women in those positions of power. But I think, from my perspective, that will be changing in the next decade. I think there are a lot of young women who really have the potential to kind of take charge and be in charge. And so I see it kind of evening out in the future, which I get excited about. I think that's going to be better for everybody overall.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just in your group alone, I mean, it's great to talk with you. I told you before we started, we spoke with Taylor Bland earlier. We have Kate Oxman coming on tomorrow to talk about some photographs that she took. So it definitely, do you see also that, and I think I asked, I don't know if it was Dylan, I asked somebody, we've interviewed a million people so far, but do you see this shift also, like you said, of the younger generation, you know, that's in, you know, that, like you said, that are just graduating, you know, that are in grad school now or just graduating college, that they're going into more of these biological studies, these ecological studies, these conservation studies, and are really taking the mantle to, you know, protect the environment and, you know, go into these specific species studies more so than before?
I don't know if it's more so than before, but there are certainly a lot of young people who are interested in it. I think one of the difficult parts of that, though, is at least my experience, and I think other people have had this experience too, getting into the field of wildlife and getting to the point where you can be successful and actually like earn a living wage at it is very difficult right now. And I think the reason for that is that it's basic supply and demand. There's a lot of people who want to do it because it's exciting work and it's really fun to do. I get to go outside for work and do really cool stuff. So there are a lot of people who want to do it and there aren't a lot of opportunities to do it. And a lot of the opportunities are either not funded very well or they don't have funding for technicians. So that makes it difficult for people who don't have like a safety net, a financial safety net, to get into the field. So for example, a lot of my jobs that I've had have been either volunteer positions or very low paying. I feel incredibly lucky to be in the position that I am now. It's definitely a rarity in the field. So there are a lot of young people who want to be in it, but there aren't a lot of young people who have that ability to do so, which is, I think that's something I've talked with my friend Aaron a lot about. And I think that kind of falls on the shoulders of grad students and advisors, people who are looking for funding to put an emphasis on actually funding technicians so that there are fewer of those volunteer positions, because I think to some degree, young people are being taken advantage of a little bit. And it also, if you look at the aspect of diversity, there's not a lot of, you have to have that safety net that I mentioned earlier to be able to get into the field. And so people who don't have that financially aren't able to get into the field of conservation, which is something that I've thought about a lot. And I think is something that conservationists in general can work on in the future.
So if you had to lend some advice to someone who was considering doing this and they want to figure out how to cut through this narrow channel, what sets people apart? Like what makes this work for someone and not for another, other than obviously a financial, you know, safety net is important in, you know, trajectories that are sort of risky.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my first bit of advice is that you have to really want it, because you have to make a lot of personal sacrifices to be successful. So that's the first thing, and understand that from the get-go. The second one is a job board. If you're looking for a position in the wildlife field, if you haven't heard about it already, I mean, if you've been in it, you probably know, but the Texas A&M job board is a really great place to look for positions. And that is a good one to look for. And then just being, you have to be able to work really hard and push yourself without having direct oversight of a supervisor, because a lot of people who are supervisors they're sending you into the forest and they want to know that you can be safe and not hurt yourself. That's one of the number one things. So some form of a wilderness first aid course or like you need to have common sense so that whoever's hiring you knows that you're not going to get hurt when they send you into the field. That's a really important one. And then another important one is just, yeah, like I said before, just making sure that you have a really good work ethic seems to go a long ways. And then just interpersonal communication, chatting with people. You have to get along with a diverse group of people. And when you're young in the field, a lot of us have hopped from job to job all over the country. I've lived in Minnesota, Idaho, and Whitewater, Montana, and here in Yellowstone. And I've met a lot of really different people. And I think having the ability to get along with all those different people and build off of those relationships is very important.
Yeah, I love it. That's great. Thanks for sharing all that, Maddie. That's great. That's really good advice, actually, for anybody who's going into this field. When you were saying all these interpersonal relationships, what was the difference that you saw? Were there any differences, or was it just a different set of circumstances when you, like you said, we were in Minnesota and then you go to Idaho and work with fishing game there and then you're in Yellowstone? Like, is there any difference, or it's just really geographic location and all these people are mostly the same?
Let's see. Yeah, looking back at it, I think a lot of the folks that I've worked with have been very similar in that we really like being outside. We're all very outdoorsy. And I definitely think that this field has a tendency to attract people who have that ability to just go and have fun, but work really hard at the same time. Work hard, play hard.
Yep.
So yeah, it's been very enjoyable.
That's awesome. I'll ask this because when you're in Minnesota in that Wolf Deer Project, what was that experience like, and what were some of the daily things that you were doing and the data that you were collecting there that you were working when you were working with Shannon?
Yeah, so the main job for that position was to set trap lines in order to capture and radio collar wolves in the Superior National Forest and in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. So the season, or the time that I was there from basically right after I graduated. So in late May until about the end of October. So it was summer and fall position. And in the summer, we would set trap lines along Forest Service roads in the Superior Forest. So we set the trap line, and then we would have to check the trap line every single morning. We couldn't miss any mornings. It was and is very important to check the trap line every morning, so that the wolves who get caught in the traps aren't in there for too long. And then in the fall, we would do that, but instead of doing it along Forest Service roads in the Superior National Forest, we set trap lines in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. So we had hitches that were 17 days, and we'd have a specific trap line, a specific area where we'd be targeting a pack out there, and we'd set traps along the sides of portages and just canoe from lake to lake and check the trap lines on the portages as you go. And there were sometimes, I did two of those. There was one where it was a loop. So we started at our campsite and were able to do a loop all the way around every single morning. And then there were the other one was a straight line. So we had two different camps. We would set the trap line between the two camps and go back and forth each day. And that was a really amazing experience. I love Boundary Waters so much. I think that everybody should go visit it. It's one of my favorite places. But yeah, so that was the main part of the job. But setting traps was a really cool experience to learn how to do that and how to do it well. Wolves are very smart animals. And setting a trap line in a place where wolves have been trapped for decades, the Wolf Deer Project started, Dave Meech started it in 1966. So this wolf population knew, they know what a trap line looks like and they know what a trap looks like. So you have to be, you have to do a really good job of keeping human scent off of the trap so that the wolves don't know that it was a trap. And there are a lot of other things that you can do to increase your chances of catching the wolf, which is very difficult. I think, I'm pretty sure the number that we caught in that entire summer and fall was 15 wolves for that whole season. So it takes a lot of effort and it's definitely an art. And there's some things that we do for trapping and collaring wolves. For the traps specifically, we have a lot of modifications to make it as humane as possible. And some of those are like the traps are coated with rubber jaws, and those jaws are offset and there's a swivel mounting, and that's chained to the base plate. So there's not a long spring. And if it gets too hot, we'll modify the traps or pull the trap line, or in the same case, if it gets too cold, we don't want the animals to be in extreme temperatures. We'll set in areas where there's shade, and we try to avoid, or we always avoid setting near water. So if a wolf gets caught in a trap, it doesn't end up in the water. Yeah, so then if we did catch a wolf in one of our traps, we would anesthetize it and go and collect as many samples as we could. So the number one priority was to get a radio collar on the wolf. And then we would take blood samples for DNA and disease analyses and body measurements, hair samples, whisker samples. I remember one of Shannon's number one priorities was to, if we are going through, putting the animal through being trapped, we want to get as much information from that animal as possible. So it was always, there was a lot of work to do as soon as an animal was anesthetized. So yeah, that was the main part of the job. And then on top of the trapping and collaring, we would also do scat surveys. So we would drive the Forest Service roads and we would have a specific route planned out. And on that route, we would look for wolf scats. And if we found a scat, then we would collect it. And so we spent many hours driving Forest Service roads and picking up wolf poop. But that is some, can get you some really good information. So yeah, those were the main parts of that job. And it was a really unique experience. And I feel very lucky to have had that.
Wow. So these wolves were practiced. They knew what these traps looked like. So you had to, you weren't banking on curiosity anymore. You genuinely had to trap these animals without their awareness of the trap. Did you ever trap the same animal twice? What would happen in that circumstance?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think that we specifically trapped the same animal twice, but I know that the project has. So they do get trapped twice. There are some, in any trapping situation, there's some animals that are considered trap happy where they like really like getting that bait, so they'll go after the bait. So that certainly is a part of the situation. But we had, I think the guys had a trap line, or maybe this is a story that Shannon told us, but there was a wolf that basically just walked down the road on a trap line and just pulled out all of the plastic baggies from all of the traps.
Makes sense.
To like warn the rest of the pack, essentially, like, hey, don't step here, which I thought was a really, really cool story. It really goes to show how intelligent they are.
So what was the bait that you were using?
Oh, gosh. I remember day one, Shannon sent us over across the street so that we lived and worked right across the street from the International Wolf Center at the Forest Service Station there. She sent us over to the International Wolf Center, and she said there's a beaver in the freezer there. Yeah. Look at the beaver and bring it over to the driveway and then chop it up and make some bait. So we got the beaver, and we just spent the day cutting up the beaver and putting it in little jars so that it could ferment. We used that as bait for the season. So that was just one example. Shannon was actually testing a lot of the different baits and lures that were and are available on the market to see which ones worked best. And that one of the keys was to keep it varied, because if you use the same thing, then the wolves get smart to it. So you have to keep using different baits and lures each time. So that was definitely a learning experience. A lot of smelly stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's they always like the smelly stuff. We noticed that even up here, you know, the smell, although some of them are picky. So when you, is that a lot of the difference between the wolf packs in Minnesota per se, and maybe in Idaho, and now when you're in Yellowstone, is that these packs in Minnesota, as Stephen was suggesting, they're so used to this trapping scenario, and are they more or less habituated to humans? Do they really keep their distance? What are some of the differences and maybe the parallels you see between the three places you've been with the wolf packs?
Yeah, habituation is a big one. Wolves in Yellowstone typically are tolerant of humans, but we have a couple of packs right now that are habituated, so they feel very comfortable being within a couple hundred meters of people. But wolves in Minnesota and wolves in Idaho are very skittish. It's a rarity to see one or hear one. They do a very good job of staying away from humans. I remember one of my experiences in Idaho. When I was wandering through the forest, as one does as a biological research technician, and I was following a game trail, and we were doing a rendezvous site survey to look for wolf sign to see if these wolves were in this predicted rendezvous site habitat. And I was just walking along the game trail. I spent a lot of time doing that, and all of a sudden, this black blur came down from the other side of the trail, walking straight towards me. And I was in the wilderness. It wasn't even the national forest. We were really deep in it. And I just like did a double take. I was like, oh my gosh, what was that? And my mind went straight to, it was a black bear. I didn't see it. It came out very quickly, and then it went away very quickly. So I was like, oh, it must've been a black bear. And I went over and looked at the tracks in the mud. And they were wolf tracks, and I was like, oh my gosh, that was a wolf. So that is, it's very difficult to be able to see animals in Minnesota and Idaho, but here in Yellowstone, that's a part of the appeal of wolf watching in Yellowstone, is that it's so much easier to see them. And it's one of the places, one of the only places or few places in the world where you can come and see wolves in the wild, which is definitely one of the keys of wolves in Yellowstone. So the differences between Minnesota and Yellowstone and Idaho there are two different wolf subspecies. So the wolves in Minnesota are Canis lupus nubilis, and those are the Great Plains wolves. And in Yellowstone and Idaho, the subspecies is Canis lupus occidentalis, and those are the Northwest wolves. So there are five different subspecies. There's Canis lupus arctos, Canis lupus baleyi, which are the Mexican gray wolves, and Canis lupus latrans. Depending on who you ask, those are a subspecies or a separate species. That one's being currently debated. But there, between Canis lupus nubilis and Canis lupus occidentalis, there's not a huge difference in size. Really, where you see the big differences between the subspecies is if you look at like wolves farther south than wolf range and wolves farther north. So if you were to compare the Mexican gray wolf with the Arctic wolf, they look pretty different. But really, between Minnesota and Montana, that's not a huge difference in the area. So there's not a big difference between those subspecies. But the main difference between Minnesota and Yellowstone wolves is what they eat, what they're hunting. So in Yellowstone, the wolves hunt primarily elk, and they'll also go after bison. But in Minnesota, they hunt primarily white-tailed deer, moose, and beaver. No matter what they're hunting, it's always dangerous for a wolf to hunt. So a hoof from an elk or a bison to a head can be very detrimental, or even a broken leg could possibly kill a wolf. And the same goes for white-tailed deer. Even though their hooves are a little bit smaller, they can still do a lot of damage.
As biologists that are judging habituation in a pack, what are sort of the textbook indicators of true habituation? At what point, what event has to occur for the community to label habituation versus curiosity versus being in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Yeah, so one of the big ones is if a wolf is approaching people knowingly, or if they are grabbing things that people have. We have one of the wolves from the Junction Butte pack last winter ended up grabbing somebody's tripod and ran away with it. That is a definite sign of habituation.
We heard that, yeah.
But yeah, we were having this conversation in the office the other day. Like if a wolf just walks by somebody within 30 feet, like they're very close to the person, but if they're not approaching the person actively, is that considered habituation?
Right.
So that's definitely a tolerant wolf, because a wolf that's outside of Yellowstone wouldn't ever be in that situation. The human would never even see the wolf.
Right.
But I would say that animal is tolerant. And one of the mantras is absolutely worst case scenario is that wolves are being fed by people. And that teaches them, they get that food reward. And that teaches them that it's okay to approach people, and they continue to do that. And that if it gets to that point, then that animal might potentially have to be removed from the population. So the mantra is a fed wolf is a dead wolf. So don't feed wolves.
Oh. Or coyotes or bears.
Don't feed any of the animals, people.
Don't feed the animals. I'll do it.
So with this habituation though too, because you're talking about going and looking at rendezvous sites, right? So you're looking for where there's a possibility of a wolf presence. What are the things, if people are on a trail, they're in the wood, really deep into the woods, let's say they're hiking, they're going camping, things like that, what are some of the things that they can look for, I guess, or what are sort of telltale signs that a wolf has been at a rendezvous site that for them to really just sort of get out of that area as quickly as possible, or to sort of leave that be what it is?
Yeah, or just to know that there were wolves there, which is cool. Yeah, so definitely wolf tracks. If you find wolf tracks, that's a pretty good sign that there's wolves there. Some of the other things we looked for, so we looked for tracks. We looked for chew toys, which are like antlers or bones that look like they've been gnawed on a whole bunch. At rendezvous sites, you'll often see like pups will bring things back from kills, or adults will bring things back from kills, and the pups will just chew on them. So that's one thing we look for. A lot of the time, if it's a very heavily used rendezvous site, you might find a patch of ground, like if it's grassy, which a lot of the times rendezvous sites are in like open meadow areas, a lot of the times near water. So we were often looking around in wet meadows.
That didn't help at all.
Yeah. And if you see a patch of dirt, like a lot of the times they use the area so much that they'll wear the grass down. So that's one thing that you can look for. And then scat. So that was the main goal in Idaho, was we were looking for scat samples. So we wanted to know if we had found a rendezvous site. And then on top of that, if we did find a rendezvous site, then we would collect as many, if not all, of the scat samples that we could find in that site. For genetic analyses, because we have the ability now with genetic technology to get a genotype for a specific animal from its poo, which is really neat. And one of the times, there was one rendezvous site that we went to, we knew that there were wolves there. We hiked up to it, and we were sitting on the side of a creek, and there was a pup still at the rendezvous site. And I assume that everybody else, all of the rest of the pack, had been there, but they probably booked it before we even saw them. But there was this pup which pups are generally less cautious because they don't, they're kids, they don't really know what's going on. And the pup was hanging out, and we stayed out of sight and watched it and waited for the pup to kind of move off and follow the rest of the pack. So it left. And so after it left, we went in and collected all the scats. And we spent hours at that site. I think we collected like 80 plus scats at that one rendezvous site, which was like a gold mine. It was great. I was so happy. And I remember at one point while we were collecting these scats, I heard like some footsteps, some rustling in the bush behind me. And I thought it was one of my coworkers who was coming up to like talk to me to ask a question or something. And so I just kind of ignored it for a second. And then it got closer and I turned around thinking it was going to be someone else. And it turns out that it was the pup had actually come back. And it was very curious. So it was coming to check me out. And I think considering that that was a wolf in a national forest in Idaho, that would be an incident of a curious pup and not a habituation, because there's not a lot of people in that area. It was pretty far off the beaten path. But it was definitely a cool experience. And it took me definitely by surprise. I turned around and just like... I definitely did a double take, fell back a little bit, and then the pup ran away as soon as we made eye contact. But that was a cool experience.
Yeah. Go ahead, Stephen. You had something you wanted to say.
No, she answered my question. Actually, she's every time I have a question, she answers it fully before I, which is great. I love it.
Maddie, you're on it. You're clearly in Stephen's head, Maddie. You know exactly what he's going to ask next.
You're on a roll.
On a roll. I love it. So you're in Idaho. I mean, Idaho's, this is fascinating. Do you know offhand, like, what are the wolf populations like in Idaho as well? Are they, I think we asked Jeremy Sundaraj this question. He sort of had a good idea. Do you know what those populations are up to in Idaho? Because I think those are increasing in number as well, aren't they?
Yeah, well, so it's difficult to say for sure, because there were estimates of the wolf population. When was that? 2015? I think it was around 700 plus wolves in Idaho, but that was a winter count. So they were doing telemetry and they got aerial telemetry and they had an estimate from that. And so that's when the population is at its lowest, and it was a different method. And the most recent estimates actually are from a non-invasive method where they're using camera traps. So in Idaho, they've put up 569 camera traps in 2019 throughout the state. And they were able to get 11 million photos of animals or just 11 million photos overall. So a lot of pictures of things. And they used a software to figure out which of those pictures were of animals, and then they used technicians to figure out which of those animals were wolves. And that was how they got their estimate for the wolf population in 2019. But that estimate was in the spring and summer, which is when the wolf population is at its peak. And that estimate was 1,500, give or take. So it's difficult to say for sure if the population has increased or decreased, because the estimates, the two different estimates are from when the wolf population is at its lowest in the winter versus when the wolf population is at its highest in the spring and summer. So it's kind of difficult to say for sure. And I'm sure I'm not an Idaho wolf biologist, so I don't know for sure, but that's kind of my take on it, or what I've heard.
Either way, it seems as though from talking to you, Jeremy, a couple other individuals we've had, that the population seem to be doing well in these more Western states. Minnesota seems to be fairly healthy, but Montana, Idaho, we have a pack now in California. It seems as though they're starting to really sort of repopulate out here naturally with everything that's going on. So I want to get back to the scat poop genetic. I want to know how this works. Because we're getting to this, but you sort of teased it before. So how are you pulling genetics, and what are the things that you're getting from the scat at these rendezvous sites, and how you're able to tell which wolves are there, and what things are you getting from these studies?
So genetic analyses are a very new thing in the field of wildlife biology. So there's a lot that we can do, and since the technology, like a lot of other technology, is getting a lot better, a lot faster, there are more things that we can find out. So that's something that I get excited about, is that is the routes that we can take to do research with genetic technology. So kind of one of the underlying themes of all of the different positions that I've done on wolves in Minnesota, Idaho, and here in Yellowstone is scat collection. So in Minnesota, we would collect scat on the side of the roads. And in order to preserve those scats, we would keep them in jars with silica beads that would like suck all of the moisture out of the scat, because moisture is bad for DNA. So that was one thing that we did in Idaho. We would collect them in evidence bags. Well, actually, what we would collect, where the genetic material is on a scat, is the very outer mucus layer of the scat, because when if you think about it, when the poo's coming out, it's coming into contact with the intestines on the outside. So what we would do is we would sterilize a tweezer with put it over a flame for a little bit, and then take a little sample from the outside of the scat, from that outer layer, and that's where the genetic sample was. So we would want kind of a moist layer that's like ideally not in the sun, if we could help it. And so that's what we would do in Idaho. And then here in Yellowstone, we'd collect the scat and then put it in the minus 80 degree freezer as quickly as possible to try and freeze the DNA, so that it wouldn't denature over time. So there's a handful of different methods for collecting scat, which have been kind of interesting to get to work for different projects and see how everybody is doing it and actually like do it, because I've read a lot about scat collection, but to have that experience using the different methods to collect scat is pretty unique. But yeah, so once you have that DNA sample from the outer surface of the scat, you can send it in to do a polymerase chain reaction, which, fun fact, so polymerase chain reaction is a way to replicate DNA quickly in the lab. So you can get a lot of DNA from a small sample of DNA, and that makes it easier to study and to get a genotype for an individual if you have a good sample that will replicate. And the polymerase chain reaction actually uses an enzyme called TAC polymerase. And TAC polymerase is an enzyme that comes from a heat-loving bacteria that was found in a Yellowstone hot spring. so it was, I think it was in 1989, TAC polymerase was named the enzyme molecule of the year, because it revolutionized the study of genetics, because we were able to do a polymerase chain reaction. So the reason that TAC polymerase is so important is that the polymerase chain reaction requires you to cool and heat the DNA sample over and over again. And so you need to have an enzyme that is resistant to high heat, high temperatures. And so we got that from the bacteria from the hot spring, because that bacteria was resistant to high temperatures. So that's a cool story, but I digress. so we can learn a lot from poo. What we do in Yellowstone. Yeah. yeah. It comes full circle. Like we have our genome because of this bacteria that came from Yellowstone, which is really neat. In Yellowstone, I'm working with, she's not a grad student anymore. She just defended successfully her PhD, Dr. Ellen Brandel. we're working on a project, or she's working on a project that I'm helping her with. And she's trying to figure out how parasite infection impacts wildlife host fitness. So what we've been doing, or what Ellen was doing, was we were collecting wolf scats in Yellowstone, and we wanted to track parasite infections in known individuals through time. So we have, from wolf capture, we have blood samples, and so genetic a genotype for individuals that have radio collars. And so we can take, if it's a good enough scat sample in the environment, we can take that scat sample and genotype it and figure out exactly which wolf that scat belongs to. And so we can match that scat with the behavior and social status of the wolf. And so what Ellen wants to do is figure out the effect of breeding status, breeding success, and wolf survival on infection status of parasites. So with one scat, we can figure out which wolf it came from. We can figure out which parasite species are in the scat, so which parasites are infecting that specific individual. And another thing that we can do is we can figure out what the glucocorticoid level is, so the stress hormone level is in the scat, so we have an idea of how stressed that animal is. So if the animal is stressed, then they probably have a poorer immune response than an animal that is less stressed, and so they might have more parasites in their system. So that's something that we're working on right now, and I think it's a really cool project, so I'm pretty pumped about it. And so some of the things that Ellen has predicted is an increase in group size. So if there's a larger pack, then there's probably an increase in infection rate because wolves will pass the parasites between each other. If they're very stressed, they probably have a higher infection rate because their stress levels have a decreased immune response. If they're an older wolf, they're probably more likely to be stressed because older individuals generally have poor immune responses. And then if they have a higher infection rate, then they probably have a lower fitness overall, so lower breeding success or lower survival rates, which is pretty neat. And so we can figure all of that out from a poo, which is great.
Now, are these parasites that are being found in wolves, are they all nefarious parasites, or do wolves live with certain parasites that they can just have an asymptomatic, symbiotic relationship with throughout their life?
Yeah, so a lot of the parasites are things that we find a lot in wolves. So tapeworms, for example, there's quite a few tapeworm species. Echinococcus is one of those. But yeah, a lot of them are things that don't really have a huge negative impact on the wolves, except that they take away some of the energy from the wolves that they would otherwise have going to their own bodies. But I remember going back to the Wildlife Science Center when I was helping with immobilization one day. We were doing temperature. So when you have an animal immobilized, you need to take regular temperatures to make sure that their internal body temperature doesn't get too high or too low. But usually you don't want it to get too high. And I remember stuck the thermometer in the back end of the wolf and pulled it out, and there was a little white thing on the thermometer, and I was like, Peggy, what's this? And she got the tapeworm. And I was like, oh, that's gross. Don't eat it. Okay, cool. Because they feed their wolves with deer a lot of the time. It's like roadkill deer. So deer from the wild population. So those deer will possibly have tapeworms, and the wolves eat that. And so they have it. And so it's just normal. It's not something that they tried to get rid of from those wolves because it doesn't really have a huge deleterious effect.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That is fascinating. Is this a new... obviously, wolf scat has been collected for, I'm sure, for decades to try and figure out certain things. Is this really a new... not new, but is this a next step in the... tracking process, you know, figuring out, like you said, these specific individuals, and is it just now another tool that you guys have in your toolbox to be able, if you can't get certain things, you know, when you dart them and things like that, this is another way that now you can collect this really important data, so you have all this stuff on hand when you guys are doing your work.
Yeah, absolutely. Wolves, being an elusive animal, are very difficult to study, especially outside of Yellowstone. So being able to get all of the information that we can from scats is definitely an important thing in the field, and it's developing. We're starting to find out even more things that we can learn from it. So it is, it's something that's just been developed recently, and I see it going pretty far. So there's another example. This one's not of wolves, but I think it's really cool. And I guess you can tie it back into wolves. But so the moose population in northern Minnesota has been having a rough go of it. The population dropped pretty dramatically in the early 2000s. And it's since leveled off, but it's still at a much lower level than it used to be. And so biologists in Minnesota are trying to figure out what is it that is affecting the moose population. And it turns out there's a lot of things that are playing a role in it. But one of those things specifically is this brain worm. If you Google zombie moose, you can find a video from the Minnesota DNR of moose that have been infected with a brain worm. And what happens with this particular species, it's P. tenuis is the species. It usually lives in white-tailed deer populations. So it lives in white-tailed deer, and the cycle is it goes from deer, and then the deer will poop it out, and then snails will go and eat the poop, and then the deer will eat the snails. So that's the life cycle, typically. And then when it doesn't really have a huge negative effect on the deer, and that's how it is able to perpetuate in the system. But when moose eat those snails that have the brain worm kind of, it gets lost and it actually goes all the way into the moose's brain, which it doesn't in the deer. And it can be fatal sometimes and make them more vulnerable to wolf predation. And so biologists in Minnesota are trying to figure out which species of snail is it that the deer and the moose are eating, so that they can figure out how to manage the snail so that the P. tenuis isn't having as big of a negative impact on the moose population. So what they're able to do is they take the moose poo and they can figure out through genetic sequencing which species of snail the moose are eating. That's one of those moments, kind of like standing on the edge of the iced over lake listening to the wolf howling, when you have to step back for a beat and then realize, like, oh my gosh, we're able to figure this out. Like, how crazy is that?
Jeez.
There's a lot that we're able to do, and it keeps changing. There's more and more, and I bet 5 years from now there are going to be things that we can do that we haven't even thought of yet.
Yeah, I'm watching the video. It's wild.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We're gonna have to send people to go watch that. Is there a? I don't want to say a connection, but is there something? And I don't know if this. I think it's impacting Minnesota too. The chronic wasting disease as well with the deer populations. I don't know if it's Minnesota or Michigan. I know it's in that sort of that Rust Belt area. Is there a way that, you know, the biologists or people up in Minnesota or up in those places are trying to combat that disease along with this brain worm with, you know, a natural way to sort of, you know, help these populations out? Are they talking about using wolves to try and cull the deer population? And like you were saying, trying to find the snail that's eating the worm that the moose are eating. Are they trying to maybe use natural predators to help with, you know, with CWD or, you know, even help with this snail issue? Or what do you know about that, if you know anything? What's going on there?
Yeah, I can't say specifically what they're doing in Minnesota and Michigan and the Midwest to curb CWD. They're definitely keeping a very close eye on it, but I'm not as familiar with what's going on there. I do know that's Ellen's next job. So now that she has her PhD, she's working in Wisconsin to study CWD out there. And I don't know if you guys have heard, but there has been a detected case of CWD in the elk herd in the Tetons. And I heard that there's CWD just outside of Yellowstone. So I think it's a matter of time before it ends up in Yellowstone. And that's certainly a thing that we think, since wolves go after vulnerable prey, if there are individual elk that are affected by CWD, then they are probably more likely to be killed by wolves, and that in that situation, the wolves will be doing a favor for the elk population overall by getting rid of the individuals with CWD. So I'm very curious to see how that plays out. It's definitely not great that it's here, but it was kind of something that we were anticipating, and it'll, I think, in the next few years, probably it'll be something that we'll be looking into quite a bit more.
Wow. Man, there's just so much. It's amazing. You have changed our perspective, or at least mine, on what can be gathered from, you know, scat, poop, and really just, and the impact that it's having clearly on the studies though. And I find that so fascinating. I mean, we, you know, we're always here. We're always looking at poop and scat, obviously, to see, you know, how healthy are the wolves and things like that. But this conversation has taken it to a completely new level, which I love that this is a way that you guys are moving forward and trying to get your, you know, get all this information and data for you guys. We just have a couple more questions for you before we let you go. What do you see? So obviously, so this scat collection and genetic sampling is the way forward. Do you see any other ways, any other non-invasive methods that are going to be probably more in the forefront as you guys continue to study wolves and elk and deer and bison and things of that sort that can help you guys?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are quite a few non-invasive methods that are people are working on a lot right now. So before I say that, I should say that there is a lot of information that we can't get without doing capture, without doing the invasive methods. Like having a blood sample is not something that you could get easily without it. For wolves specifically, like unless you're capturing a wolf, you when we capture wolves, we're looking for breeder status by measuring the nipple size on females. And that's something that you couldn't do with non-invasive methods. We get weights and tooth measurements and whisker samples. So there's definitely information that you can't get unless you're doing the invasive methods. But some examples of other non-invasive methods besides the scat collection are camera trapping, like I mentioned in Idaho, is a really big one that a lot of biologists are using to get ideas of population in an area. There's one, so Shannon, I love Shannon. She's doing a lot of really cool research, trying to kind of like push the boundaries. So one project that she did was she was trying to figure out if we could get enough DNA from wolf tracks in snow. So what they did was they were collecting snow underneath wolf tracks. They collected enough of it from a few tracks to see if they could get enough DNA like that has been sloughed off from the pads from the wolf's foot. And it turns out that it's very difficult to, so there are different levels of DNA quality. So if you have a tissue or a blood sample, that's great. You're probably going to get a good DNA sample from that. And the scats, it depends on the situation the scat is in. So if it's in direct sunlight, like UV radiation, denatures proteins, denatures the DNA molecule. So that's not ideal if you have a wolf scat that's been out in the sun, or if it's been raining, or if it's really humid, that's not great. So that's kind of like the next tier down is wolf scats. Like you could get a really good sample, or there's a good chance that it's just not good at all. And then the tracks is kind of the next tier down where you, like, there's a chance, but the chance isn't great. But that's another thing where as the technology improves, we'll be able to get replications from even more scant amounts of DNA. So that's something that I'll be curious to see what happens in the future. And then track surveys and citizen science. That's something that the state of Wisconsin employs a lot. They have a citizen science where people go out and track, and they've gotten a lot of information about their wolf population in Wisconsin from that. And setting up like scent traps to see if wolves come up. So just like a pole, a smelly pole, and they'll count the tracks to see if there's wolves in the area. And then another one is like audio recordings and howling. where, and howl surveys. I forgot to mention in Idaho, that was another thing that we did. If we were in a rendezvous site, we would howl and try and hear a response, which most of the time we never did. But there were a handful of times when I was very surprised to actually hear a response from a wolf. I was like, oh my gosh, there's actually a wolf there. That was wild. But yeah, the audio recorder. So this is one that Shannon just did with the captive wolves at the International Wolf Center. They used these devices called audio moths, where they were recording wolf howls, and they put an audio moth like in the center of like the wolves at the wolf center, and then at different distances away from the wolf, from the wolves, to see how far away could you be from the wolves before you like stopped hearing them. And so it was harder. You didn't detect as many howls from further away. But she wants to know if that's something that she can employ in the future. She puts that out in the Superior National Forest. Can she tell like what the wolf population is just from the howling that she records from that? So that's another thing that she and other people are working on. There's another biologist, Dave Osband, who did a similar thing a while back, and he actually developed a recording device like that, but it would howl. So it had a recorded howl that it would emit, and then it had a recording period after it howled to see if it got a howl back.
Wow.
So yeah, it takes a lot of creativity. That's one of the things I love most about this, is the people in the field are very creative scientists who are like coming up with new ideas constantly to learn new things about how to study the animals that they're studying.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love it. Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of creativity and I mean, a lot of passion with all of you that we've interviewed throughout the course of this. The last thing I want to ask you is, and I, when you hear the word wolf, what is something that comes to your mind?
When I hear wolf, I think the first thing that comes into my mind is that they epitomize wilderness. So when you're out on a frozen lake, or in a forest in Idaho, hearing a wolf howl or seeing a wolf, if you're lucky enough, or seeing wolf tracks, is definitely something that makes you think like, yeah, I'm in the wilderness. So they epitomize that sense of wilderness, and they give us a sense of wonder. I think wolves have that unique ability to invoke our sense of wonder that makes humans human. We're very curious as a species, humans. We want to find out more. And wolves kind of bring that out of us. And I think the reason for that is that wolves are very similar to humans, and that they're incredibly intelligent. They're incredibly social. And that's another reason why I think they're so polarizing, is that they're so similar to humans. So they, like there are some cultures, like in the Ojibwe culture in northern Minnesota, the wolf is seen as brother. And in European culture, the wolf is seen as competitor. And I think the reason that both cultures see it that way is that they recognize themselves a little bit in this species. Which I think is really cool. So it's really neat being a wolf biologist and learning as much as I can about the species. There's always just something that is mysterious, which is really neat about wolves. So yeah, that sense of wonder.
I love that. Maddie, this was great. I again can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing all the information you have. Please let people know, is there a place where they can follow you on social media? Is there anything that you've published or studies that you're working on that they can check out some information, whether it be in Minnesota, Yellowstone, things like that? If you have any of that information, please let everybody out there know where they can find stuff.
Some of the best resources for finding out more about wolves in Yellowstone specifically would be the NPS website for Yellowstone. There's a lot of really good information on there that's free for everyone. You can get the annual reports there that we publish every year. we're working on the annual report for 2020 now. And the Wolf Project just published a book called Yellowstone Wolves, Science and Discovery in the World's First National Park. That is an absolute wealth of information. So anybody who wants to learn more about wolves in Yellowstone, that one is a definite, like, yeah, you should read that. It's got a lot of great information in it. It's a collaborative effort that synthesizes the 25 years of wolf research in Yellowstone. So definitely check that out. For the International Wolf Center, their website is wolf.org. If you have any questions about wolves at all, you can find the answers there. So that's a good one. And then for the Wildlife Science Center, for anybody who's from Minnesota, who lives in the Twin Cities, or anybody who's, I don't know, planning to go through Minnesota, I would highly, highly recommend going to visit the Wildlife Science Center. It's about an hour north of the cities driving. And their website is wildlifesciencecenter.org. So that's a good one to check out. And then again, for anybody who is wanting to get into the field more as a wildlife technician, the Texas A&M job board, the website is wfscjobs.tamu.edu. That has all of the job postings, or a lot of job postings there. So that's a good resource.
Maddie, you're a wealth of information. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us everything today. This is awesome. I really appreciate the work that you're doing and all the studies and, yeah, your forays into the world of poop. I mean, what else is there to say? But thank you so much for everything that you do. howls to everybody out there, and Steve and I will be with you next time. Bye, everybody. Looking to support Wolf Connection or sponsor one of the wolves in our pack? Just go to wolfconnection.org, click on the donate tab, and find out more information.